Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to the program. For those of you who just joined us, we're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. Today, we're going to talk about two issues. In the second part of our program, we're going to look at detoxification, A to Z. What does that mean? What does it mean to be toxic? We're going to explore it. Right now, let's take a look at some of the latest in health and nutrition update information. I've selected information that generally is not available through most of the mainstream media. I've tried to select stories that, more often than not, we're given a very biased perspective on. We're just not given the full facts. And if we were, it may change public opinion, which could force political decisions, economic realities, and the health of our environment. Let's go to those. This comes from the BBC News Tuesday of this week. Chernobyl children show DNA damage. Scientists say there is evidence that low radiation doses can cause multiple changes in human DNA that are passed on to future generations. They found, quote, an unexpectedly high increase in mutations among children born after 1986's Chernobyl disaster. The children were born to parents who had cleaned up the reactor and who were conceived after it exploded. The scientists do not rule out the possibility of prolonged effects from the mutations. The scientists from Israel and Ukraine report their findings in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of Biological Sciences. Now, what does this mean? This means that just like our Three Mile Island disaster that was covered up in a special in-depth investigative report, I'm going to give you a whole different perspective of what actually happened, and more than 50,000 deaths in infants that spiked within 3 months after that were later erased. In fact, we had the original reports, mortality reports in infants, so we know that they were erased because later on, those reports had normal figures. Anyhow, the same thing seems to be true here. We're told that low-level radiation is not a problem. And yet, Alice Stewart and Dr. Ernst Sternglass, Dr. Jay Gold, and so many others have said it's exactly the low-level radiation that we should be concerned with. So now we're seeing the effects in Chernobyl, post-Chernobyl. This comes from A New Scientist magazine. And I want to cite this because this is the information we just don't hear. In the 1950s, Alice Stewart found that exposing pregnant mothers to X-rays doubled the risk of cancer in their children. Ever since, the physician and epidemiologist argued that low doses of radiation may be harmful. It's a view that's been has put her at odds with governments, the military, and the nuclear industry. This week, Stewart, who is 93, publishes new research supporting her claims. Michael Bond spoke to the maverick of radiation epidemiology and found her in fighting form. What new evidence do you have to support your claims that low-level radiation could be dangerous? She says radiation safety standards are derived from studies of the atom bomb survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These studies were food for people supporting the hypothesis, the theory that a little bit of radiation can be good for you, that it stimulates the immune system. When it was found that a small number of the atom bomb survivors were living longer than they ought to, this was seen as proof that radiation had done them good. But we have new data that should be paid attention to. We have proof that the A-bomb data have been wrongly interpreted. Now, what does this research show? Well, it shows that cancer was not the only effect of the A-bomb radiation. People died from immune system damage as well. Our paper also shows that the atom bomb survivors were not a normal homogeneous population. They were the best athletes, the top 10%, and did not include the young and the old. This means we cannot base standards of radiation safety on such an elite cohort. I think that this new paper will reassess the harmful effects, but I don't think it'll lead to an immediate reaction. Why do you think your findings always take so long to be taken seriously? Take your work in the 1950s showing that a fetus exposed to X-rays has a higher risk of cancer, or your findings in the 1970s that workers at the Hanford Weapons Complex in the United States were getting cancer after supposedly safe levels of exposure. The trouble is that I've always had a very small setup with only just enough money to employ people to do the research. I've never had a department that's out selling the message to other people, so it's been a bit slower than usual. When it comes to my work on X-rays, nobody wanted to believe it. X-rays were a favorite toy of the medical profession. But much more than that, it was just the moment when the nuclear industry was taking off. If you were right, the industry couldn't develop properly. I moved to Birmingham University for that reason, that I was going to get a lot of criticism. And I knew that if I stayed at Oxford University, I would always be under the thumb of the authorities. But that is the extraordinary thing. I can have reason to be angry with the persons at Oxford because they were powerful and I was weak. We can have no reason at all to be angry at me, and they shouldn't have, but they were. Yet, something irks these people about me. And I'm conceited enough to think he and they suspect I'm a better epidemiologist than they are. Now, they will tell you that they have never quarreled with me about this. Well, they have. They've quarreled about my methodology on the Hanford studies. Why? They criticize my methodology from the word go. I don't know why. They even criticize the mathematics of George Keel, my mathematician. But they don't know a fraction of the mathematics George knows. I don't know what they mean when they say our method is wrong, but they should be called to account. The main objection to my X-ray study was that the mothers were lay informants, that they weren't scientists, and they could have made up stories. We always knew there was a weakness in our story, but we'd done our best to check this through the hospitals where they had their X-rays. So we're happy with that information. Anyhow, that's an interview with a remarkable person. In fact, I'm flying over there to film her. We're doing a documentary on low-level radiation right now. And her work is very important because she was one of the lone critics saying low-level radiation is bad for the immune system. And yet everyone else was saying, no, it's not. Well, she was right. This comes from one of our audience who sent this to me, Carol Koff. Thank you. And it comes from a group that's interested in exposing some of the problems with fluoride. And by the way, a major report, major investigative report, will be released by me within the next 2 to 3 weeks on fluoridation, and it'll be up to date to the moment. We're working on it right now. Once completed, it will replace the ones I have on my webpage. And then following that, I'm doing a new one also on low-level radiation, giving you the latest on that. But this is entitled What Dentists Don't Want You to Know. And this is from the New York State Coalition Opposed to Fluoridation. That a public health dentist stop from being published. A Dr. A.K. Masarkarenas authored published research, probably using our tax dollars, about one of fluoride's adverse effects, dental fluorosis. Often studies critical to fluoride don't make it into journals, or information detrimental to fluoridation is edited from abstracts. So we applaud Dr. Masarkarenas for publishing her work. However, Dr. Masekeras successfully caused the following news release from being published, as her email in a public forum indicates, which was forwarded to us and is pasted on at the end of the release. Why are dentists so protective about fluoride? Why don't they encourage rather than discourage the dissemination of this information? Here's what it says. Quote, there is substantial evidence that fluoridated water, fluoride supplements, infant formulas, and fluoride toothpaste are risk factors for fluoridosis, unquote. Alone and Together reports Ohio State University researcher Dr. Anna Masekeras. And too often, dentists and physicians misprescribe fluoride. She writes, quote, in Risk Factors for Dental Fluorosis, a review of the recent literature, unquote, in Pediatric Dentistry, 422-2000. In small amounts, fluoride added to water supplies and dental products is hailed as a cavity fighter. Slightly more ingested fluoride can spot children's teeth, white, yellow, or brown, forever. It's called dental fluorosis and is increasing at alarming rates. Only expensive cosmetic dentistry covers it up. Quote, dentists don't know where fluoride's alleged benefits turn into risk, unquote, says lawyer Paul Beeper, president of New York State Coalition Opposed Fluoridation. Quote, dentists advise parents to monitor their children's total fluoride intake, but how? What foods contain fluoride? How much fluoride's in those foods? How much is absorbed or swallowed from fluoridated dental products? And what's enough? Unquote. Lesser known fluoride sources are tea, ocean fish, mechanically deboned meat products like chicken nuggets and baby food, air pollution, ocean and shower mist, medicines, foods, and beverages produced in fluoridated communities, fluoride containing pesticide residues on produce and grains, and some bottled water without fluoride listed on the label. Dentists and physicians are taught to never prescribe fluoride supplements to children who live in fluoridated water areas, but many still do, reports Masekeras. Besides, quote, there is substantial evidence for the risk of fluorosis from the use of supplements in fluoridated and non-fluoridated areas, she writes. Now, that's why the Canadian Dental Association and the Western Australia Dental Service no longer recommend routine fluoride supplementation. She writes, quote, dental fluorosis is a condition in which an excess of fluoride is incorporated into developing tooth enamel before the age of 9. Microscopically, fluoride affects the forming enamel by making it more porous. Fluorosis is seen as white spots or white opaque lines or striations, or a white parchment-like appearance on the tooth surface. The brown stains, sometimes seen in moderate to severe fluorosis, are due to the uptake of extrinsic stain, mainly from the diet, unquote. So, there you have it. So, dentists are not getting this information out. People are still suggesting fluoride supplements, but there is no nutritional need for fluoride, and we still have it in our water. Right here in New York City, we have fluoride in the water. Not good. Doesn't do us any good, only does us harm. This comes from an article about how the people were misled about mad cow disease in London. This comes from the WashingtonPost.com, London. Government officials misled the public for years over the dangers of British beef and the risk of mad cow disease spreading to humans, according to an official report released today. The 2.5-year inquiry concluded that officials and ministers in Britain's previous Conservative government, haunted by fears of consumer panic and the loss of valuable beef exports, doggedly stuck to a mistaken, quote, campaign of reassurance, unquote. Lack of communication between key government departments and unacceptable bureaucratic delays also hampered the response to the crisis that first struck Britain and its herds of cattle in 1986 and claimed its first victim 10 years later. Prime Minister Tony Blair's Labour government said it planned to set up a compensation plan for the victims of the human form of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which has so far killed over 70 people. Well, they wouldn't be alone in hiding the facts. Our government agencies are still hiding facts about almost everything, including Gulf War Syndrome. This comes from a Dr. Michael Nicolosia, an interesting report. I'll share it with you. It deals with vaccines and vaccine ingredients. Let me read this here. Some of these vaccines are grown in the cells of human fetuses. Please review the following information. The ingredients of vaccines should make each one of us stop dead in our tracks and not ever consider putting these ingredients into our bloodstream or our children's bloodstream. Now, here's what we have. And each one of these, by the way, I won't go through all the citations, but each one of them is cited, meaning there's a scientific reference for each one of these. I'll just give you the overview. Vaccine ingredients, from the physician's desk reference, that's the source. So there you have it. Every doctor in America knows this. The DTP vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine, manufactured by Lederer Labs. It's produced using formaldehyde. By the way, that's also the same formaldehyde used to prepare dead bodies. Thimerosal, which is a mercury, aluminum hydroxide, aluminum phosphate, by the way, aluminum is related to Alzheimer's, polysorbate 80 gelatin. Then the hemophilus type B tetanus vaccine by Connaught Laboratories. They use ammonium sulfate, formalin, sucrose, thimerosal, again mercury, measles, a virus, the live virus, and they use neomycin, which is an antibiotic, sorbitol, hydrolyzed gelatin, and chick embryo. Then the diphtheria vaccine, produced by SmithKline Beecham, aluminum phosphate, formaldehyde, ammonium phosphate, and washed sheep red blood cells, glycerol, sodium chloride, porcine, which is pig pancreatic hydrolysate of casein, that's dairy. So you're getting stuff from sheep, pigs, cows in one single vaccine. And how do we know? Just here's a hypothetical question. How do we know that those pigs weren't fed rendered animals? How do we know the cows weren't fed rendered animals, making them potentially susceptible to mad cow disease? We don't know. So if there were any, let's say, deviant prions that cannot be killed by heat, then they could be in that solution. You have no idea how many individuals that I have counseled who could not figure out how they got herpes. Never occurred to them they got it through the vaccines. Or hepatitis through vaccines. Vaccines get the element right into the body with no protection. Hepatitis A vaccines, SmithKline is the maker. What do they use? Formalin, aluminum hydroxide, phenoxyethanol, which is antifreeze, polysorbate 20, residual MRC5 proteins, human diploid cells, which, by the way, originate from human aborted fetal tissue, and then the rubella and Muntz virus. There they're using neomycin, sorbitol, hydrolyzed gelatin, human diploid cells. I'm looking at all these vaccines, and here are the ingredients that are not told to the person. There's no way that you would know you could have a reaction. There's no way of determining, are these uncontaminated? Any one of these can be uncontaminated. Now, we have certain animal species that we know are highly susceptible to contamination, like chickens and eggs. There's a particular virus in chickens called leucosis, and it can be transmitted to humans. It causes like leukemia. Well, when you're using a influenza, a flu virus, and I'm reading the ingredients here from the physician's desk reference, it's saying embryonic fluid. That means chicken egg. Neomycin, that's an antibiotic. Polymyxin, thimerosal, mercury derivative. And the inactivated polio vaccine uses formaldehyde, that's embalming fluid. Phenyloxythionyl, that's antifreeze. And neomycin, antibiotic. And streptomycin, an antibiotic. You're giving antibiotics, embalming fluid, and antifreeze, along with a poliovirus directly into the system. So, better be careful, because this is what you're not told. All right, let's continue on. We'll give another one here. A little later on the show, we're going to talk about detoxification. And you can detox, by the way, from any adverse effects that have come from vaccines, including, I have a new protocol that is showing enormous promise right now, helping autistic children who have been damaged due to vaccines. This comes from Reuters, New Orleans. 8 patients may have been exposed to a rare and fatal brain ailment after they were operated on with the same instruments that had been used on a person who died of the illness, officials at Tulane University Hospital say. The patients were notified of the danger after it was discovered the instruments may have been tainted by Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, a variant of which is linked to mad cow disease. The instruments received routine washing and sterilization after being used earlier on a patient later found to have died of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease by the hospital. And then they found out that, well, they've got a problem of spreading the risk of brain wasting ailments that may not have been eliminated. The Wall Street Journal said the incidents began in March when the original patient underwent surgery, but the hospital in New Orleans did not tell the other 8 patients the problem until this week. The hospital, in a statement by its vice president, Alan Miller, said only that, quote, 8 patients who potentially have been exposed have been contacted, and we are providing counseling and related medical care they need. Well, this is an irreversible condition, and there's nothing they're going to be able to do. I would suggest that they should look at using ozone to disinfect, because ozone can kill microorganisms that even high heat cannot kill. And also, I would put all those 8 patients on a double-day ozone intravenous protocol, because it has knocked out virtually every other microbe, including long-time resisting microbes that nothing else had worked on. But they won't do that. They will monitor them. The people will panic. They'll be highly stressed. And in all that, the person is going to find their immune system take a tumble. They'll be given medications. The medications will have secondary effects, and it'll all speed up the death process. That's called treatment by cookbook medicine. It doesn't work. This comes from William Falone in the November issue of Life Extension, an article entitled, Can You Trust the Government's Database? Found this an interesting article. When searching for medical information, a popular place people check out is a database called Medline, which is maintained by the National Library of Medicine. This free service provides instant access to abstracts published in more than 4,000 scientific journals. And while Medline can provide valuable information, it is by no means the final word as it relates to scientific validation. There are other medical databases, sometimes emanating out of Europe, which contain published studies that Medline often omits. If you're seeking an important piece of medical information, you may miss it if you stick strictly with Medline. The problem of omitted studies on Medline was the subject of an article that appeared in the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association. The doctors writing this article used Medline to find 19 clinical trials supporting the use of saw palmetto extract in the treatment of benign prostatic enlargement. These 19 studies alone were quite impressive, but this article showed that there were 39 published studies about saw palmetto or other databases that were not found on Medline. The doctors pointed out that Medline only listed 33% of the total published studies on the clinical use of saw palmetto in the treatment of benign prostatic enlargement. What does this mean to the person seeking novel methods of preventing or treating disease? First off, when you hear some so-called expert being interviewed by the media on a medical topic, you should know that the expert is usually relying on Medline as their source. In 1994, a major television network was trying to attack the Life Extension Foundation for promoting saw palmetto extract. The network had a Harvard professor who said there was no evidence that saw palmetto was effective. We conducted a worldwide database search in 1994 and found 28 published studies substantiating the benefits of saw palmetto. Upon presenting this scientific evidence to the TV network, the issue was immediately dropped. If we had to rely on Medline back in 1994, the evidence would have been skimpy. By using European databases, we documented saw palmetto's efficacy and prevented the media from destroying the credibility of this important herbal supplement. Dr. Julian Whitaker and Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw and others have sued the FDA to force the agency to allow a health claim that saw palmetto extract is effective in helping alleviate urinary symptoms associated with benign prostatic disease. The FDA's position is that saw palmetto cannot be sold as a dietary supplement if a claim is made that it has been shown to ameliorate symptoms related to prostate disease. The FDA is not saying that saw palmetto is ineffective or dangerous. Instead, the FDA's contention is that saw palmetto has to go through the torturous new drug approval process if health claims are to be made for it. This flies in the face of the meaning of the laws passed by Congress in 1991 and in 1994 that specifically permit these types of health claims on dietary supplements. If the FDA has its way, in federal court, no one will be able to inform Americans about the published studies supporting the efficacy of saw palmetto extract and many other natural supplements that cannot be patented. If a supplement cannot be patented, no one is going to spend the money taking it through the FDA's drug approval quagmire. This means that under the FDA's current legal theory, Americans are to be denied access to information about natural approaches to alleviating disease symptoms and instead should rely exclusively on expensive, side-effect-prone FDA-approved drugs. We view the FDA's position as blatantly unconstitutional since the agency's basis for denying consumer access to saw palmetto extract is based solely on the fact that a certain health claim is being made. Consumers fought long and hard to convince Congress to deny the FDA the ability to embargo sales of dietary supplements based solely on health claims. The FDA is now seeking to circumvent the will of Congress and the people by stating that the First Amendment does not apply to certain types of health claims, even if the claims are true on dietary supplements. Up until now, the federal appeals courts have ruled against the FDA on all these issues. We view the FDA's latest attempt at censorship to be particularly egregious, considering that millions of American men are already using saw palmetto extract to alleviate urinary discomfort. We hope the federal courts will continue to rule in favor of the First Amendment as it relates to health claims instead of allowing the FDA to censor truthful information at the behest of drug companies who seek to deny Americans access to low-cost herbal remedies. Meanwhile, back in the real world of science, a new study published in the Journal of Urology showed that saw palmetto extract causes a specific contraction of epithelial prostate gland tissue. This new finding may indicate a mechanism to explain the clinical efficacy of saw palmetto. This placebo-controlled double-blind study conducted at the UCLA School of Medicine adds to the growing body of evidence supporting the safety and efficacy of standardized saw palmetto extracts. In a recent German study, Dr. H. Schissler makes an interesting comparison between drug and herbal-based prostate therapies in the following statement. He said, quote, "All in all, far more experimental and clinical studies have been conducted with herbal prostate drugs than with fashionable drugs such as alpha-1 receptor antagonists and Proscar," unquote. As most individuals may know, saw palmetto extract was approved as a drug in Europe to alleviate urinary miseries in the early 1980s. Yet here in the United States, we are in the year, going on the summer of the year 2001, battling the FDA and federal courts just to be able to convey the results of published peer-reviewed journals to the American consumer. According to a study published in the prestigious journal Nature, considered the greatest scientific journal in the world, life expectancy in the United States and other industrialized countries will continue to rise, but with slowdown in sight. The researchers who conducted the study forecast the average lifespan to be around 80 in 7 nations, which exceed government predictions. In Japan, life expectancy may be an astonishing 8 years longer than currently predicted, or up to 91. The Japanese are already the world's longest-lived people, and some studies suggest the isoflavon and polyphenol-rich Japanese diet plays an important role in their remarkable longevity. In the United States, our life expectancy is much, much lower than that, almost 15 years lower. The investigators in the Nature study found that in each country, death rates for all age groups dropped exponentially at a constant rate. With the amazing series of discoveries in medicine in the last century, the researchers report there is no compelling reason that the future will be different. The investigators attribute the increased life expectancy progress made against heart disease and stroke and age-related killers. And these investigators predicted that further advances should allow even better control of age-related diseases. Well, I certainly agree with all that, and we're doing our part. And when you consider today, people are taking coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E and vitamin C. They're shifting from a meat-based to a plant-based diet. And then you look in Italy and you see that when you do a blood work up there, people have higher natural killer cells that protects you against cancer. There, especially in the northern country area, the average lifespan is now between 90 and 106. 106. Could you imagine that? And if you go there, and I have many times, we're not talking about old and feeble in a rocking chair or in a nursing home. We're talking about out there vigorously engaged in life every single day. Look at their diets. Look at their lifestyle. Look at their temperament. So it's more than zinc and selenium. It's taking everything into account. And we will probably peak. In fact, we've been rather at a level where we haven't gone forward. And there'll be a big shift now that the baby boomers are approaching 50, 55, 60. And seeing, are they going to radically change their lifestyle so they can really push back the hands of time? They can. It's an individual decision. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, okay, let's say we haven't lived the perfect life and we've kind of polluted ourselves along the way. What can we do to undo some of the damage? It's called detoxification. That's where we're going to go in a moment. Please stay with us.